Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. So you've heard about it in my newscast. You've probably seen it on a lot of your television news as well, read it in the newspapers. There are several districts in Connecticut that are putting armed and unarmed guards in place on their campuses. And in fact, there are some school districts that already had security guards essentially in place. But this has become a very hot topic as schools are back in session for the 2022-23 school year. And I thought, who better to talk about this, normalize the conversation a little bit more than our own Gary McNamara, who is the Chief Executive Director of Public Safety and Government Affairs at Sacred Heart, also the former Chief of Police in Fairfield and just a good friend of mine, somebody I'd love to have on the show. Gary, hello. How are you, friend?
I am well, Melissa. Thank you for having me part of this discussion. It's great.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Gary, my understanding is you are actually in current discussions with several districts as they're trying to bring on this new approach to school. What are some of the things you're hearing from teachers and parents about this?
Well, I think the key word there is discussion. And oftentimes what happens when we go to these debates about should we or shouldn't we, it just turns to yes or no. And there's so much more to it. And the point of bringing these discussions around is to really saying, what is the state of safety and security in your schools? And then really, you know, let the people who are involved in that kind of provide the guidance, because there's a lot more to it than just saying yes or no. And even if you say yes, okay, we have armed guards, then what? So it's really part of a overall holistic approach to keeping our schools safe, just like it would be a holistic approach to the way in which we, you know, provide gymnastics or athletics to our school districts. You really can't just singularly take one topic in school safety and then, you know, go yes or no without looking at the holistic approach.
So obviously, Gary, you have a background in law enforcement, and I would imagine you are for the idea of having some sort of presence on school campuses now.
I am. And I think the reason is that, you know, if you look at a school district, in the district, who is really the person responsible for safety? Meaning their whole purpose is just to make sure that the district is safe. And then you take it to the school level. You have a structure in place at the school level. Okay, the principal's got responsibilities, teachers, you know, the janitorial and support staff have functions. Well, who in that function, who in that little pyramid is responsible for the safety of the school building during the day? And whether you want to believe it or not, you need to have somebody that's responsible for that. And if you don't have somebody, you have to kind of find that person. The problem becomes when we focus solely on the gun. And, you know, should they have a gun in school? And what happens is that's when it's the dividing line. When I try to focus districts to say, look at the person that you're hiring. Because the quality of the person that you're hiring, you want somebody that's going to go in there. Obviously, prior law enforcement is a requirement if they're armed. But you want to look at the quality of the person. Can that person understand the school culture? Can they fit with the school culture? And then, as in addition to that, if a problem were to occur, wouldn't you want that person to also have the ability to maybe shave seconds off of a response to stop death? I mean, that's really ultimately the discussion. You can't just go right to the gun, and that's what people do. And if parents go right to the gun and teachers go right to the gun, kids go right to the gun. You know, I mean, there are districts that have armed guards that wear guns that are hidden. Mm-hmm. They're not uniformed. Some of them just wear very casual business-like attire that they're integrated into the school culture.
Mm-hmm. Gary McNamara is here. He is the Chief Executive Director of Public Safety and Government Affairs at Sacred Heart. He also is the former Chief of Police in Fairfield. Gary, it's something very common that I say on my show because I witness it from my own friends, even my own self as a mom. I've seen it where you project your own fears onto your kids a lot of the time. And I think some of the times when I hear about these conversations that parents are feeling, you know, this is too much for my kids. They're overexposed. I think to myself, and granted, I'm not saying I disrespect anybody's opinion on the matter. Is it scary? Of course it is. But I look at the fact that, you know, my kid at 3 years old is already doing active shooter training in school. So it's already there. It's already the world that they're sort of living in. They're already exposed to it. And I look at, you know, when you go to, and you and I talked about this, you know, metal detectors in schools, like, why why is it totally acceptable when we go to airports to have your newborn go through a metal detector just to get on a plane, but it's so out of the ordinary to have your six-year-old go through a metal detector to walk through school. So I think a lot of the times we project our own fears onto our kids. So I do agree with that. It's the way that the conversation has to be steered. Here's what I'm very interested and curious about, and maybe you could weigh in on this because you were, like I said, you were at Fairfield PD when this happened. Was there as much of a conversation of having security guards on campus after Sandy Hook happened? Because it is interesting to me that after Uvalde, that's when school districts are like, hey, we got to do something. And I'm like, that's crazy to me, only because Sandy Hook, you know, almost 10 years ago, that to me would have been the turning point for all Connecticut municipalities to say we need someone at every school.
Yeah, there was that same discussion. I think it may be a little, there was. But there was a lot of discussion on some of the other stuff. That's really the big push after Sandy Hook, where we really looked at from the state perspective and statutorily requirements of school districts to have a real focus on school security, infrastructure, modifications, video cameras and such. And school armed guards was a discussion. I think it's more of a discussion nowadays than it was. But nonetheless, I think it's an important discussion. You know, Melissa, what I hear is that some of the conversations I have with parents in some of the districts are they're just happy to have the discussion and to get that perspective. And so, you know, I find it fascinating to have those discussions. And at the end of it, they have a better understanding of, hey, well, you know, let's have further discussion on the direction that our district should go in, because, you know, these discussions have to be had, but we can't automatically go to yes or no, thumbs up, thumbs down. I mean, there's so much more to it than that.
Now, Gary, give me an idea. As the former chief in Fairfield, especially when I was growing up in Fairfield, I vaguely remember, and maybe I've got this wrong, you know, kids don't really pay attention anyways, but I vaguely remember there being like a police officer, maybe a car that would go through the parking lot, you know, every couple of hours or something. But I don't remember there being per se like a security guard or like a police presence in elementary and middle school in Fairfield. Am I wrong in that? I don't remember that, at least.
Yeah, there wasn't. I mean, initially when I first came on, there was the officer friendly program, basically an officer going into the schools talking about the DARE program or, you know, stranger danger type conversations. But and I think in the high schools we had some security officers, a few. I think it was after Sandy Hook we really looked at it and said we need to have a focus on presence inside our schools. And, you know, you talk about earlier, you're talking about the finances behind it. Well, we realize as a district, we have 17 public schools. It's hard to put in the costs are a lot to put a person in every school. So what we did was we formed a school unit, and then we provided one officer would be responsible for a few elementary schools, you know, kind of being that contact person. And obviously some of that has changed. But if you recall, Melissa, we had to lock down all of our public schools several years ago due to a threat at the same time. And each of those schools is its own separate pod. You know, like the district, the mothership is kind of hands off, because every school becomes its own little pod of a lockdown. Mm-hmm. Now, in that lockdown, in that school, you know, the lessons we learned are phenomenal, because you learn how, you know, what you can do. And so that's some of the discussions that I have with the districts. But, you know, who in that school is going to be responsible for security while they're locked down? Who is just that person that can consult and have those conversations and provide that guidance? So we find it useful. I think it's a really important thing to do.
So,
you know, one more point, Melissa. Go ahead.
Oh, no, go for it. I was going to say, would you say that most, like, bigger municipalities, like a Fairfield, I'm thinking even like a Bridgeport and Norwalk, anything like that, do most of them go that plan of attack?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it really depends on the district, depends on the culture. Every school district is unique and different, and we got to really look at that. But I'm saying that there are options out there. Financial, there are options. There are options for whether they're uniform, whether they're, you know, casual, whether or not they're business-like attire. What I was going to say was that the frustrating part about this is this turns to a debate, and security isn't about a debate. You know, hands up, hands down, how many say yes, how many say no. Okay, the vote was taken. We said no. This district said yes. It doesn't make the school safer whether you say yes or whether you say no. The districts, all communities, parents, teachers, everybody has to get together and say, we are going to do what we can to make our school district safer. And in order to do that, we have to assess what our safety presence is right now. What does our footprint look like right now? How can we make it better? Consult with people that understand it rather than just those that have this one-off debate, yes or no, because it's a volatile conversation and there's emotion behind it. And until you break that emotion and realize what the purpose is and who the people are behind the vote, then you might understand that you're actually putting some pretty good qualified people into a building where our most precious people exist, and those people are pretty good at handling crisis and will make the school safer, I believe.
Gary, my last question, because I've had some calls about this, and I have to obviously confirm with different districts, but budgetary, you know, we talk about how expensive it is. I don't remember which school district I heard it about. I want to say Old Lyme maybe, but I can't remember. But it was like $50,000 per armed guard to put in the schools. And when it comes down to it, whether it's taxpayers, whether it's out of a school budget, what would you say, you know, as far as like if a town or city is going, hey, we would love to have this, but we just can't afford it. Like, do you think it comes down then to the state offering money, or, you know, is it, you know, or should school boards be like saying, hey, let's cut this, but we've got to make sure we've got the security guards? Like, what would you say?
Yeah, I think just saying, well, we don't have the money, we'd really love to do it, we just don't have the money. I mean, then you really don't really want to do it. I mean, if you really want to do it, if you assess your schools and you look at it, I think there's a way in which you can fund it. Now, you know, $50,000 is a lot of money, obviously, but in districts that spend a lot of money on schools, maybe there's probably some of that money that can be had. And at the end of the day, we've seen from some of these cases, the money spent not doing anything will far outweigh, you know, the loss of life, obviously, and the lawsuits and other issues that go on should an incident occur, way outweigh the $50,000 you'd spend up front. And at the end of the day, it's an investment in money, it's an investment in people, and policies and procedures and training that really are going to keep our schools safe.
Absolutely. Well, Gary, I really appreciate you coming on, giving us this full-length, in-depth conversation about something that I know a lot of families and teachers and schools are talking about right now in Connecticut. So I thank you for bringing that conversation here to WICC.
You got it, Melissa. Thanks for always having me on.
Back on the show with us is Julie Balke, and Julie is here each and every week. She is our career strategist on the morning show. And interestingly enough, according to the Los Angeles Times, some remote workers may soon be in for a pay cut. And you might be thinking, well, that doesn't sound right. But we're going to dive into that this morning with Julie. Good morning, Julie. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great.
You know, so we were...
Pay cut. Ooh, icky.
It is icky. And, you know, and you and I kind of talked about this a little bit, you know, how, you know, the times are a-changing. We learned a lot from the pandemic. People are more capable of doing things remote. So then why would they be getting a pay cut?
So it has been shown over and over again that there were a lot of cost savings when you work remotely. So, for instance, gas, you know, gas, wear and tear on your car, wardrobe, lunches out. And some companies are coming back and saying, well, we should be getting some of that. In other words, you're working at home. Mm-hmm. So maybe, are you willing to share in the benefits? Are you willing to take less money for working from home? And what's interesting, Melissa, is that for years, and I mean years, like way before the pandemic, there were survey after survey saying that workers, and I mean workers of all generations, not just the youngest, were willing to take a pay cut for more flexibility. And they weren't necessarily, we've known for a long time that pay is not the number one thing that people love about their jobs. It's mm-hmm. not a motivator.
Sure.
So for decades, people have been saying, and truly a couple decades, people have been saying, I need the ability to manage my life. I need flexibility. And it was always on the top of their list. So now here we are, and we've got this situation where employers are saying, okay, put your money where your mouth is.
Oh, that's interesting.
The problem is, so I see two things here. First is that once you've given someone a pay bump, it is so hard to take it away. Mm. Even if I said to you, I'm going to give you a 5% pay bump for, you know, to get you through this inflationary period. But once inflation goes back down to this level, I'm going to take it away. You might say, okay. But when the time comes to take it away, you're like, well, wait a minute. And so it's much harder. That's why I'm not really a fan of just giving inflationary pay bumps, mm-hmm. because you really, as an employer, then committed to that number. Anything feels like a pay cut. But the other way to look at it is, if you are going forward as you're hiring positions, if you're a company and you're saying, okay, we're going to, as we hire moving forward, we're going to have two tiers of pay, one for in-office work and one for homework. And so if you're a project manager and you choose the in-office route, we'll pay you X percent more. But if you choose the in-home route, you know, you'll get a slightly lower salary. And I am confident that there are many, many workers who would say, absolutely, I will take that, because they recognize that there are a lot of benefits, not just financially in the money you save, but also in peace of mind, the ability to really manage your life. And that is, that's the golden handcuffs these days. And so I would say for employers, think carefully before you implement any of this.
Do you feel like, though, a little bit, Julie, that that's kind of a cop-out? So, like, for example, so I agree. I think that's a great way for employers to get people to come back into office, is have a little incentive. I get that. But, like, you know, to be honest, are people really, you know, so I hear what you're saying, that if you work from home, you know, yes, you know, paying for gas, okay, that's something you don't really have to worry about. Maybe childcare, that probably goes down significantly as well. So I could see it, but what is that kind of a cop out though? Like, are you really paying people based on the amount of money? Like, I think if, you know, if you're somebody who is traveling, you know, you're sitting in Merritt Parkway traffic every single day here in Connecticut, you know, are you really being compensated for the amount of gas that you need to use?
Not
or are
really.
You just getting, right, you know what I'm saying? Like, is that kind of a cop out for employers to be like, well, now that you don't have to, you know, leave your living room, you know, I can cut your salary.
Yeah,
but you weren't really paying me for my gas. Let's be
it
real.
Is.
You know what I mean?
I think it's dangerous.
I think so, too.
I think your very best people are the ones who have other options. And so you're not going to lose your mediocre performers over this. You're going to lose your better people, the people that have options. You know, for some reason, this just popped into my mind. Years ago, you know how you get frequent flyer miles when you travel.
Mm-hmm.
Companies tried to take those. So, like,
I remember that. I don't know why
remember
I remember that, but I do remember that happening. Yes.
And people were saying, no. When I travel for work, this is my extra compensation for being away from my family for so long and for the hassle of travel. And so most companies backed off of that. So now, you know, I look at this as, look, you know, you're paying people for a job to get work done.
Yeah.
If
this,
they are getting the work done, why would you want to throw some gasoline on that fire and potentially lose them? But I know some employers are going to do it, and those are they're on the bleeding edge, and they are going to, I think, be sorry, because they're going to lose some really good people. But you know what's going to happen too is, you know, we've been talking about this quiet quitting, quiet firing, all this stuff, ghosting, all these passive aggressive behaviors that both sides of the table show.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm working at home, and all these studies showed that people who worked at home during the pandemic, their productivity went way up because they used some of that extra time to work.
Yep.
Right. And so now it's like, oh, okay, you're paying me. You're cutting my pay 8% because I'm working from home, turning off that computer at 5:00, talk to you tomorrow morning at 8:00. And so boundaries will become firmer. And then when you're asking for people to put in more, you sort of lose your ability to ask for lots of extra effort when you've gone back and said, you know what, what you're in effect saying is, I don't believe I'm getting everything out of you when you're working from home, so I'm going to cut your pay. So people will respond in kind. With every action, there's a reaction.
Yeah. And that was actually what I was going to say, Julie, was there are so many studies that came out during the pandemic that people were more productive at home, that they got more done in less time, actually. And like a lot that gave sort of the thumbs up to remote working. So that's another thing that could just be really challenging with this, is how do you then look at a worker and essentially tell them you don't trust that they're doing everything that you want because you're not monitoring them. Like that's a rough conversation to have. Yeah,
it is. But you know what? It's everywhere, because now we see companies coming back with all these monitoring software to measure your keystrokes. And of course, people have like, okay, you know, there's a way to make it look like you're doing those keystrokes. So, you know, there's a way to make it look like you're still online. And so no matter what you do, there is a reaction or a technology or a way for your people to
beat the system,
you know, to counteract it.
Mm-hmm.
And so why don't you just give your people clear expectations, goals for the week, and then get out of the way and let them do the work. And if they aren't doing the work, well, you know, that's, you know, then you address that instead of saying, I don't trust any of you.
Well, now you have tangible proof that you've got a lazy worker or somebody who's just not doing what you need done.
Exactly.
Oh, Julie Balke, I tell you, I get so many phone calls whenever you come on the show. Thank you so much for being here, our career strategist. We're talking about how you might be seeing some pay cuts if you're a remote worker. This was a Los Angeles Times article. Some remote workers may soon be in for a pay cut because of different costs that essentially companies feel like, hey, you know what, you don't have to pay for things like your gas or maybe your childcare or things like that. You're working from home, so I don't have to pay you as much. But, you know, it's funny, Julie, and I was thinking about this, and one of my listeners who's always on it whenever I hear from her, this was another thing I was thinking of is as an employee. Now, of course, I don't work remotely. I have to be in studio, and I prefer it that way. I'm okay with being in person. But if I were a remote worker, especially if my numbers are good or consistent or whatever the case may be, this was something that's worth talking about. You know, the fact that office spaces, like companies probably are going to see huge cost savings with remote workers from office space, your furniture, printing, toner, whatever you use when you're there. Now that you're not there, couldn't you kind of counter and be like, yeah, so I don't pay for gas anymore, and that's great, but you also don't pay for my office space. Like, isn't that something you could counter say to an employer if they wanted to cut your pay?
Yeah, and, you know, I know several people at companies who said, crap, you know, we just signed a 5-year lease or a 10-year lease.
Right.
But yes, organizations are for sure going back and trying to negotiate those contracts, those leases. And yeah, when you look at what they're saving in terms of heating and space and, you know, any of the things that go into maintaining an office building, yes, they're saving as well. But, you know, it's as we know, leadership at organizations are always looking at every angle, and there just seems to be, I'm just going to say it, an arrogance at the top of a lot of organizations that you're lucky to work here. And, you know, this is the first generation to go, yeah, maybe not so much. Maybe I'm going to find somebody else who feels like they're lucky to have me. And so the playing field has been leveling the last few years with the talent shortage. And that's what that does. But organizations have been run in a top-down paternalistic fashion for so long. And all of the management and leadership in those organizations grew up in a work world that was like, I'm the boss. I have the bigger title. I'll tell you what to do. And changing that way of looking at leadership has been an ongoing challenge. Because, you know, you hear the term servant leader, you know, meaning, you know, I am here as your manager to help you, enable you to do your job better, to serve you. That is just something that some people get, and those are the people want to work for. But there's a lot of people who are really like, oh, I got promoted, so I must be smarter than you. I have a better title. I must be smarter than you. So you will do what I want. And that's why there's books. There's just, I mean, so much written about how to be a better leader. But I don't really see that needle having moved in the last several years. It just, you know, we know what it takes to be a good leader, but I think the world is great. I think we are greatly deficient in great leadership.
So, you know what I'm hearing, Julie, which I'm glad you're touching on, and maybe we continue on with the conversation at some point. You know, we hear a lot about why remote working is so, you know, oh, I don't know if it's for us, you know, because all we hear about is generational. Like, all we hear about is boomers running companies who don't like remote workers. But at the end of the day, like, I got to be honest, there are no boomers running this company, Connoisseur Media, and they want us here in person. And I'm not saying anything bad about them. I love the company I work for, and it works very well for me. But there might be people who'd want to work, like, for a company like the one I work for. And you can't say that's a generational thing. That it may not be a generational thing. That may just be, look, this is the way we prefer working. And I guess what I'm getting at is you know, maybe we have to get away from the conversation of like a generational norm or being archaic. And, you know, is, you know, are companies really putting best foot forward for leadership? Like, is this really the best way to run a company? I think that's kind of the question versus like, you know, do we need to just look at a you know, younger leadership, for example, because that may actually not be the case at all.
True. Yeah, it's multifaceted mm-hmm. situation. And, you know, I would say, okay, how do we know, if I was a leader of an organization or department, I'd say, how do I measure productivity? How do I know whether my people are doing their jobs well or not? Mm-hmm. What are the measures? What are the measurements that we use to know whether they're doing their job? And if part of how you're measuring whether someone's doing their job is if they come into the office 2 days a week and attend these group meetings, you know, you can certainly say that. I mean, you can certainly make that a part of your requirements. Both of my son and daughter-in-law live right over the border in Wisconsin, but they work for Chicago companies. And before they moved up an hour and 15 minutes away, they had a conversation with their companies and said, is this okay? What is expected? And what the company said was that you come in at least 1 day a week. And they do it. But they will tell you that when they go in there, they get nothing done because everyone's chat.
Right.
And so make sure that you're measuring the right things. And if you can't articulate how what's required is tied to company bottom line, customer satisfaction, whatever measures you use, you know, I think you've got to go back and take a second look at that.
Mm.
Is this the fact that I want to see eyes on people sitting at their desks? Why am I requiring this? How does this tie back to the things that really make our company successful?
Right.
Or is it just a bias I have? And
that's interesting.
If it is just a bias I have, is it worth it or not? Am I going to start to lose my best people?
Yeah, that's a good question. Julie Bauke, I love these conversations. I thank you so much for coming on each and every week. I know we'll check back in with you next week with a brand new topic. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Talk soon. Bye-bye.
All right. Julie Bauke is our career strategist here on WICC. We'll check back in with her next week for a new topic. So 1 week ago today, the former president of the Soviet Union passed away. And usually on Mondays, every other week, we have Brad Woodworth on the show. And because we didn't have a show yesterday for Labor Day, Brad is here this morning to talk about this significant passing. And so, Brad, welcome back to the show. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So first of all, tell us about this man, his life, his legacy, the importance of this, the significance of his passing.
Yeah. So those of your listeners who remember the Soviet Union will probably remember this fellow, Mikhail Gorbachev, a really rather friendly fellow who's remembered for smiling much more than any Soviet leaders had before. He came to power in 1985 and then was there until the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. And you mentioned he was a president. That was a role that actually was created really right towards the end of the existence of the Soviet Union. We should remember he came to power as the head of the Communist Party. So it's a really interesting figure who tried to move his country from a place in terms of the relationship between politics and the people into something that really could be sustaining, but instead, from that point of view, his efforts failed.
Mm. I mean, so he was 91 when he passed away. Did he still hold a lot of significance for Russians, even when, you know, the current president Vladimir Putin came into office?
Well, yeah. So when he left office, that is when his office disappeared, because there was this coup against him, an attempt by Soviet hardliners in August 1991 to remove him. Again, no one, until it actually happened, no one thought that this multi-ethnic state, the Soviet Union, was actually going to disappear.
Mm.
But this coup against him gave an opportunity for all of the different— there were 15 so-called republics in the Soviet Union to say, we're finally going to announce an independence. And the coup failed. The head of the Secret Service, the KGB, had committed suicide, and several of them then jailed. And then in December of that year, the then-elected heads of the Soviet Russian Republic, the Soviet Ukrainian Republic, and the Soviet Belarusian Republic met in a lodge in Belarus and just decided that they were going to declare the Soviet Union to not exist anymore. And with that, the home, in a sense, right, the state, the country that Soviet citizens had lived in disappeared. Now, for lots of people, that was a very welcome thing, particularly people in those small Baltic republics that they had been pushing for independence for several years. And most people outside of the Russian Republic were happy that the Soviet Union was no longer in existence and that they could chart their own ways as newly independent countries. But for tens of millions of Russians, this was a great tragedy.
So we're talking this morning to Brad Woodworth, who's a historian. He comes on every couple of weeks ever since the war between Russia and Ukraine broke out earlier this year. And we talk about just big stories that are happening, and what it means for us here in America. So with this, it's interesting that you just said that, Brad, because what I was going to point to was the fact that, yes, a lot of Russians actually made a very public farewell. There was a ceremony over the weekend, and yet it seemed like it was all kind of snubbed by President Putin, which I found very interesting.
Oh, yeah, so absolutely. Well, Gorbachev had criticized Putin for at least the last 6 or 8 years, certainly since 2014. So even though the Soviet Union collapsed, Mikhail Gorbachev believed in the people of his country. I mean, he was a fundamentally very trusting. He was someone that believed in our human beings' nature to create a better world for ourselves. Mm. Now, he was a socialist. He thought that would be the best way to create a society in which all workers, you know, as Americans might say, not just the 1%, could really benefit. He thought that people of differing ethnicities, different religions, could get together and build this socialist future. So I was just going to say that when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, you know, a lot of people, a lot of Russians blamed him, right? That we lost our greatness because of Mikhail Gorbachev. Other people might say, look, you know, this country had so many deep problems, and he started to address them. He had just started to address the murder of millions of people by Stalin in the 1930s, Soviet citizens. In the 1990s, when things economically for many of people got also just worse, they looked back at that, the 1970s and 1980s in the Soviet period, and thought, you know, we didn't have it so bad. Putin did everything he could to keep Gorbachev's ideas of bringing people into power, allowing elections, to keep that down. Gorbachev himself in an interview just a couple of years ago said that he had heard that Putin had given orders to his elite to shorten Gorbachev's tongue, was the phrase in Russian. So yeah, Putin did look at Gorbachev, you know, stood by his casket, but did not attend the public ceremony honoring him.
Now, what did Gorbachev think of what's going on currently between Russia and Ukraine?
So Gorbachev himself has had family with roots in Ukraine. He himself was from southern Russia, close to Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
So Gorbachev was of this generation, as most Soviets, that certainly didn't see a reason that Ukrainians and Russians couldn't live together. I mean, again, especially in eastern Ukraine, they had for over 300 years. What Gorbachev really valued, though, was he really valued people's participation in helping to decide how the societies would go forward. Gorbachev accepted elections in 1989, 1990. He accepted the end of the Soviet Union. He could have resisted. He could have used violence.
Mm-hmm.
But for him, what people wanted was ultimately the most important thing. And Putin is just a completely different person. Putin believes in power. He doesn't. He's not trusting his own citizens.
Yeah, it seems that way. What a significant passing! And I appreciate you breaking it down for us, Brad, and really also relating it back to why this matters to us here in the U.S. Thank you so much for your time, always.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, Brad Woodworth here.